Ladies and gentlemen, good evening. I'm Crosby Kemper, the director of the library. I'm sorry that we're starting a little late, but you all have been having too much fun. Don't let it happen again. Part of the fun, obviously, is music downstairs, and I do want to point out to everybody that more music after the program, after Chuck and Dan, as well as Boulevard Beer. All right. Which leads me to thanking both Boulevard and the Mid-America Arts Alliance as our co-sponsors in this event. We really want to thank them and helping out with the spectacular exhibit of Dan White's photographs, which Chuck will talk about, and you get a chance to talk to Dan about it too. And this fabulous celebration of Kansas City jazz with the Jim Merritt Quartet? Are they a quartet? Quintet?
Yeah, quartet. I think we'll have a few people sitting in.
Okay, and a few people sitting in later, so some Kansas City traditions will be honored. I do want to tell you, this is the advertising portion of the program. I want to tell you a little bit about a couple of upcoming programs that we've got. First of all, tomorrow night, right here at the Central Library, I think that's right. Yes, thank you. We have Carl Cannon. Carl is a Washington journalist of renown, and he is the co-author of a book called The Circle of Greed. You can imagine what that's about in our recent history, and should be a lot of fun. Carl's presented here before. He's really good. On Friday night, we have a special program. Lillian Lincoln Lambert, who has written a book called The Road to Someplace Better, which is about her story of rising from very humble beginnings to be the first African-American woman to graduate with an MBA from the Harvard Business School. A lot of great programs coming up. We also have our Writers at Work program with Chang Rae Lee, one of the best younger voices in American fiction, Korean-American writer. At the end of the month, on April 28th, we have Mike Feinberg, who is one of the co-founders of the KIPP Schools as part of our ongoing What Works in Urban Education program. And then next month, to find out about it, you'll have to sign up on our get our emails or our snail mails. Sign up to get on our mailing list. But next month, continuing our great jazz tradition of tonight and many other nights, we have Terry Teachout, Kansas City's own Terry Teachout, one of the foremost music critics and indeed cultural and literary critics in the United States today, who's just published a really interesting biography, a great biography of Louis Armstrong called Pops, to great acclaim. And Terry will be here in May. So please sign up on our cards. They're available outside. If you're not already on our mailing list. We have a lot of great programs, and one of the reasons we have great programs is we have great partners, and Chuck Haddix has been working with us for a long time. And most of you, obviously, in this audience probably know Chuck. He's probably literally the guy who needs no introduction. You know, if you want to get fish fried in Kansas City, you got to find the fish fryer himself, and that would be Chuck. Most of you know that he runs the Marsound Archives, one of the great glories of jazz archival material in the world at UMKC. Many of you will know that he has co-written the definitive history of Kansas City jazz, which is called, in a brilliant stroke of titling, Kansas City Jazz. You may not know that he is working on what will probably be the definitive biography of Charlie Parker, called Bird on the Wing. He's in the middle of working on that. You know, of course, the Fish Fry program, which brings great music to us on Friday and Saturday nights. What you probably don't know is all the information that is stored in Chuck's head about Kansas City jazz, and I try and pump a little bit out of him every time I see him or every time I pick up the Kansas City Jazz book or the Bird on the Wing. Some of you might have seen some of our Meet the Past programs that are on KCPT. Well, I interviewed Charlie Parker. We brought Charlie Parker back, and I interviewed him. But everything, not only that I knew about Charlie Parker, but everything that Walter Coppedge, who played Charlie Parker, knew about Charlie Parker, came from the brain of this man, and it's been one of our more successful programs. But I'm going to tell you something tonight that I found out for the first time, or actually I had to reread it tonight from Kansas City Jazz. Only from Chuck would you find out. I mean, you'll know part of this. Some of you who are jazz aficionados will know part of this. You know that Benny Moten first got his sort of national wings, if you will, by playing on WHB from the Playmore Ballroom. Is that right? Was it the Playmore?
El Torreon
Ballroom on WHB, and because of the miracles of the airwaves, WHB went out across the country, and it was one of the first big hits of Kansas City jazz, one of the first big hits of jazz on the radio, and certainly made Benny Moten. What you would not know, unless you knew Chuck Haddix or read Kansas City Jazz, is that WHB was owned by the Sweeney School of Automotive, Tractor, and Aviation. And so I give that to you here tonight because you can win bar bets unless you're in the same bar with Kansas City's own Chuck Haddix.
You know, and one thing you didn't know about Crosby Kemper is he's a hard act to follow, that's for sure. And I want to thank Crosby, along with Margaret and Henry, for doing such a great job of putting this program together and for sponsoring the fine art of Kansas City jazz. A few years back, I had the pleasure of serving as curator for this exhibit and working with Arlette Cleric and the rest of the staff of the Mid-America Arts Alliance. And as I wrote the text panels, in the biographical sketches for the exhibit, I focused upon the individual portraits that I was working on. And as my grandmother says, sometimes you can't see the forest for the trees. And seeing the exhibit fully realized, of course, the sum is always greater than the parts, but the result, of course, is just stunning downstairs. And we certainly hope you'll wander downstairs after a little session up here and enjoy some more delicious Boulevard beer and some Kansas City jazz and spend some serious time with this exhibit, because this is something very special. And this goes out, this is a traveling exhibit, and it'll be out for 4 years, and it brings a little taste to Kansas City, to places like this across the country, and we certainly can use that. To label Dan White as a jazz photographer is really a disservice to his art. He's a photographer, in this case, whose subjects happen to be Kansas City jazz musicians. His background in photojournalism informs his art, and every picture well tells more than a few stories. And he uses a large format camera for this project for greater flexibility of expression, and it also allows him to physically manipulate the angle, exposure, and composition of the images. Photographers are always taught, when we take photos, we're always taught not to move. Well, Dan breaks with that convention and moves the camera to a stunning effect in the case of Myra Taylor and a lot of the other images downstairs. And he's also the master of light and shadow. And these techniques, combined with his intuitive eye, really capture the essence of his subjects. I first encountered these photos in 2006. I was with Jazz at Lincoln Center doing a book signing for Oxford University Press. And they were celebrating Kansas City jazz. And it was interesting because, you know, New Yorkers have a tendency to be kind of parochial. There's nothing out there besides New York and L.A. You know, there's nothing in between. However, we were serving up Boulevard beer and also ribs. And everybody talked about the ribs. Everybody went crazy. And I turned the corner, and there's this oversized portrait of Myra Taylor. And I didn't know it was going to be there, my friend Myra Taylor. And Dan really captured the essence of her being, and the beatific expression on her face really captured her soul and her embrace of life. A couple of years later, when the staff at the Mid-America Arts Alliance approached me about being the curator, I really jumped at the opportunity. Now, I didn't curate the show in a traditional sense where I selected the images and the placement, etc. Dan had already selected the photos and knew exactly what he wanted, how he wanted them printed. He's very picky about that, and presented. And believe me, you don't want to get between Dan and his artistic vision. He is a passionate, intense artist. And the images had been selected, but the exhibit lacked narrative panels putting Kansas City's jazz tradition in perspective. And also, they lack biographies of the featured musicians. The Kansas City history part was easy. I wrote the book on the subject. Telling the stories of the musicians was a little more challenging. I knew a lot of the musicians in the exhibit, but the project really turned out to be a process of discovery, because for a lot of these artists, there was very little biographical information. So I began calling friends of the musicians featured in the exhibit, and in some cases, I really found out more than I wanted to know. While researching guitarist Sonny Kenner, I called his childhood friend Lukman Hamza, and I was surprised when Lukman informed me that he had been the best man at all of Sonny's 7 marriages. I discovered that bassist Duke Samuels was a narcoleptic who wore a pipe with a cover on a chain so if he fell asleep, he wouldn't burn the house down. David Bassey told me a great story about they were wondering where he was, and he was out in the car asleep out in front of the club. And when I inquired about drummer Bobby Bang Bang Stafford, the women I interviewed smiled wistfully and recalled him fondly as a ladies' man. And he also took metal drums to the gigs so that if a fight broke out, his drums wouldn't be damaged. And you know, when you're dealing with an exhibit like this, and you're a writer, and you're writing text to complement the photos, the bar is set very high because of the quality of Dan's work and how he really captured these artists. And so I sought to do that with the text panels and also with the biographical sketches. Unfortunately, time doesn't permit me to feature all of the photos in the exhibit, but I thought we'd look at some of my favorites, and along with photos from these artists earlier in their career from the Kenneth Labuddy Department of Special Collections in the Miller-Nichols Library at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. And also we'll enjoy a taste of their music. Here's a gentleman that needs no introduction to Kansas City artists, Kansas City audiences, rather. Milt Abel and Betty Miller. Originally from Philadelphia, Abel moved to Kansas City in 1953, where he met his musical soulmate, pianist Betty Miller. And she was kind of the brains behind the operation, too. They married and formed a popular duo that played leading local venues. And during the 1960s and 70s, they maintained their home in Kansas City while playing extended engagements at Mr. Kelly's in Chicago and the Dunes Hotel in Los Angeles. After Betty passed in 1977, Abel became an in-demand sideman and, of course, led his own trio. This is Dan's treatment of the subject, and it's kind of similar to the early photo, actually. The bass lends itself to a vertical shot, which is accentuated by the cloth draped in the background. Now, those of us who knew Milt well remember him driving around in an old van all the time, these ancient vans. But he was an elegant guy who was comfortable in tuxedos. And this portrait really reflects that elegance. And the light from above Milt's face gives the portrait a simple, classical feel. It's a timeless image that could have been taken during the 1930s. In fact, it harkens back to those earlier days of photography when musicians would get these dramatic prints to distribute for their gigs. Now, Milt was known for his whistling rendition of Big Noise from Winnetka. Chris, you want to cue that up? Chris? Cool, he's in the back. He was moving chairs earlier on.
in from Winnetka, and run out again.
Big noise from Winnetka, from Milk Haven. And Linda Abel donated Betty and Milt's collection to the special collections at the university a couple of years back. And she hadn't been able to deal with her grief of losing Milt, and so she and Milty and Chloe came by. And they showed, you know, came by, and they wanted to see the collection. And one thing anybody that works in a library will tell you, if you don't do the right thing by a collection, it will come back and haunt you, because you'll have a relative showing up, and they'll say, where's the collection? You'll say, oh, it's back there in the closet. But we had really worked this collection really nicely and put it in books, in archival order. And she stood there and cried in special collections because she was just so moved by it. And that often happens. I cry in special collections a lot, too. Mostly tears of joy when I get a collection. Okay, here's our old buddy, Jay McShann. This was taken at the Offbeat Club in Chicago about 1938, when Dave Dexter brought him up there, when Dave moved there to write for Downbeat. And Hootie, of course, is all dear, dear to our heart. And he, of course, received his nickname Hootie after drinking too much spiked beer at a jam session and getting, quote, hootied. He's originally from Muskogee, Oklahoma, and he led the last great big band to come out of Kansas City. And it was a member of the Jay McShann Band that Charlie Parker first really gained national fame. And World War II ended his big band, but he's formed a small rhythm and blues combo and continued touring, and before settling down in Kansas City about 1960. And starting in the 1970s, his career underwent a great revival with tours of Europe and a number of recordings. And I always heard a rumor that he kept a packed suitcase by the door so that if any time when he got the call, he's ready to go. And he loved traveling, loved people. This is this photo was taken at Jay's house. Mary Ann did her best to keep Dan from taking this picture, but Dan prevailed. And Jay's sitting at a spinet piano when Dan took his photo. And he had such a radiant smile that Dan used minimal light for this intimate portrait of a true jazz legend. And Jay first became known nationally for his recording Confessing the Blues, and it was the flip side of his first big hit, Hootie Blues, and Charlie Parker's first commercial recording. Let's hear a little Confessing the Blues as we contemplate the joy of Jay McShann. Second track. I do that a lot on the fish fry. Just gotta let it roll. The horn section plays behind the piano and the beat, and it gives it a lazy feel.
I stand before you with my heart in my hand. I want you to read it, Mama, hoping that you'll understand. Well, baby, Mama, please don't dog me round. I'd rather love you, baby, than anyone else I know in town. Because you're so nice and loving, and you have such pleasing ways. If you take me to your home, be that the rest of my days. That's the truth, Mama. Well, you know I wouldn't lie. If I don't love you, baby, well, I swear I hope to die. Well, baby, don't you want a man like me? Well, baby, don't you want a man like me? You think only about future, forget about your used to be.
Yeah, Jay Hootie McShann, man. One of the saddest days I ever had when I went and picked up Jay's collection and walked downstairs and all his stuff, you know, laid out, all his awards and stuff. We got into his passports. Man, did he travel. Didn't he ramble? He had about 20 passports. And the places that he went to, it's just wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. What a dear friend he was. He was a really good hang. There's a very funny story downstairs on the wall that's told by Eddie Saunders about Jay McShann. Be sure and check that out. It's hilarious. Myra Taylor will always tell you that she got the job as a dancer and kept it as a singer. She began her career as a dancer in the legendary Sunset Reno Club. She'd walk back and forth between the two. She could walk through the front door of the Reno, but she had to sneak in the back of the Sunset because Piney Brown wouldn't let her come through the front door because she was underage. She worked as a vocalist in Chicago with Lil Armstrong and Earl Father Hines before joining the great Harlan Leonard Band in his Rockets. She left the Rockets during World War II and joined the USO and entertaining troops overseas. And she continued working with the USO through Vietnam. She tells some great stories about being out in the jungle in Vietnam. And for the next 40 years, she toured the world enjoying adventures, rivaling those of Bing Crosby and Bob Hope in the road movies. Dan photographed Myra in his studio. He made her comfortable in an overstuffed chair and then played her CD in a really good stereo set and, quote, cranked it up. Myra is singing along with her favorite person, herself. to get this effect, Dan lit Myra with a strobe flash and the background with an incandescent light. He then moved the camera during the long exposure, and the strobe kept her nice and sharp, and the hot lights blurred the background. Now, here's Myra's signature song. This song just fits this picture so well. This is My Night to Dream.
Don't mind how bold I might seem. You're just a boy who wants to be shy, and I'm just a girl who wants to know why. And I've got to make you see that you belong to me. Even the moon is in on my schemes. This is my night to dream. Ooh, bye tomorrow.
And that was Myra's signature song when she wanted to come out and really knock the audience out. And a lot of the times she's playing theaters and noisy clubs and ballrooms and all that. But whenever she came out and sang that song, the house would just fall silent. She had that kind of a powerful presence. And that earlier photo of her is something else, isn't it? Man, I keep coming across photos of Myra. She a lot of pictures of her. Our next, Speedy Huggins. Kansas City's nightlife. Wonderful photo of Speedy. Speedy was known as the king of Kansas City nightlife for his late night sojourns from club to club. When I used to hang out at the Grand Emporium, you'd see Speedy and Speedy go, "Are you going to Jardine's later on, man?" You'd start working the crowd, lining up his next ride. He was originally from Fort Smith, Arkansas, and grew up in Kansas City, Kansas, where he taught himself how to dance. And in 1933, he performed at the gala opening of the legendary Cherry Blossom Club. That's where Count Basie first held court. And throughout the 30s, he toured widely with the Three Clouds of Rhythm and other dance groups. After serving in World War II, Huggins returned to Kansas City, where he remained a mainstay on the music scene, making the rounds night after night. Chris, can we play that DVD track? He was aptly named, as we see in this video clip from Last of the Blue Devils. And if you haven't revisited Last of the Blue Devils, you should. This new edited version of it's quite nice. We'll see if the magic's going to work here. Here we go. There we go.
The drummer used the other afterbeat with, of course, his hand. Very simple thing, but it was a distinct thing that the Eastern musicians hadn't used before. It just caught fire. It was just a kind of a homey thing that made the people, made them want to dance, as you say. And, of course, that was the thing that did. This is what we would consider at that time as Kansas City Jazz.
It's earlier than that, late 70s, yeah. Bebe Huggins. Go back to the photo there, if you would, Chris, please. Yeah, that's taken from The Last of the Blue Devils. And if you haven't seen it in a while, I highly recommend you revisit it. I really taught a course at the Kansas City Jazz History Art Institute, and I revisited that. And I hadn't seen it in a long time. And, man, it's just evergreen. Now, Dan originally wanted to photograph Speedy's hands, but he also loved his hair. And so he made his hair and his hands the focus of the photo. And the beauty of Speedy's skin, the timelessness of that, is accented by the black and white film. And what Dan did is he etched Speedy's face by making the background of the shadow side of his face lighter than the background on the camera side. And unfortunately, Speedy wasn't very well documented, but he's on Tim Whitmer's CD doing a nice version of Kansas City. And Tim tells a story about how Speedy was asleep in the corner in the studio, and they said, "Okay, Speedy, it's time to sing." And he got up and he did it in one track. It's like that. As Sonny Kenner, he's beautiful. Sonny grew up in the heart of 18th and Vine district, surrounded by music coming out of the clubs. In fact, he had an apartment below, above one of the clubs, and it was on 18th Street. I'll remember his name in just a minute. And his uncle used to beat on the floor with a broom all the time, saying, "Turn that music down." And in 1953, Kenner joined Sonny Thompson's popular rhythm and blues band. They called it cat music in those days, later became known as rock and roll. In the early 1950s, Kenner settled down in Los Angeles and worked as a session musician. He accompanied James Brown, Little Richard, Joe Sample. He also played guitar on the big hit by the Rivingtons, Oop-Oop-Pa-Mow-Mow. He moved back to Kansas City in 1965, where he taught guitar and toured regionally with his own group. And he moved easily across a broad range of styles from jazz to reggae. It's kind of funny because when he was teaching, he would advertise his that he taught by putting these posters up on light poles, and they were everywhere, and they were impossible to get off. And I asked him, I said, "How did you do that?" One time he goes, "The secret's in the glue." Now here's Sonny posing for Dan, and this is interesting because if you look at this, the shadow doesn't match him. This is where the art comes in. What Dan did is he juxtaposed light and shadow to create depth and dimension. Dan used a cutout of a photo he took of Sonny on stage at the Levee to create a shadow by laying it on the floor and lighting it from behind while lighting Sonny from above. And the light on top of his head creates really an angelic effect, and the well-worn Stratocaster provides really a gritty counterpoint. I mean, he's dressed so eloquently, and he's playing this old beat-up guitar, but that's the guitar he played. Now, Sonny liked the song Sunny Side of the Street so much that he composed his own version, Sunny Side, and he used it for his theme song.
Doorstep, the back doorstep, the side doorstep, just leave them and direct your pretty little feet to the sunny side of the street. Mama, don't you hear, can't you hear, what's the matter with your girl, you're deep? That happy tune is at your footstep. Life would be so sweet on the sunny side of the street. I used to walk, oh, but I'm riding now upon that Jomo's Fleetwood Cadillac. But baby, 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 I'm not afraid. Just a rover, here over, come on, cross over, just like good little doggy. Yeah. And if I ever have a sin, I mean, you say a bang, you throw a mom, ain't gonna be like that. I got gold dust at my feet. Why be half sick? Sunny side of the street.
If anyone was more aptly named, is Sonny. He had such a sunny personality. What a beautiful guy. And he really played a wide variety. I mean, he'd have rappers come in. He was very inclusive. And he was just what makes me sad is so many of these guys who were my friends, they're all gone now. But fortunately, they live on in their music and also these wonderful images that Dan took of them. One thing about Ben Cannard, he always played to the audience. He always still plays to the audience. And he served in the Army band during World War II, and after the war, he joined the wildly popular Lionel Hampton band. While with Hampton, Cannard composed Red Top, a song that became a big hit nationally. And it was written for his wife, who had red hair. And he left the Hampton band in 1953 and returned to Kansas City. Like a lot of musicians, he had a family and he wanted to settle down, so he went to work for the post office. It didn't keep him from playing night after night. He just had two gigs instead of one. Now this photo is very interesting, and this is taken in the music hall, in the entrance of the music hall, a memorial at Municipal Auditorium. And it provides a dramatic backdrop for this photo of Ben. Dan created the slice of light that illuminates Ben, and he was always a consummate showman, and that comes across in this. He's decked out in his band uniform, bending over backward in a theatrical pose while playing his baritone saxophone, giving the photo a sense of drama and motion. And Dan stood on a ladder and shot this photo from above. What I like about it is the interplay between the design of the uniform and the theatrical mask on the floor. Even though he received no credit for writing Red Top, he's always delighted playing it. This is Red Top. Thank you. Ben Kennard, man. Woo. Last but never least, Rusty Tucker. That's him right there on the left. You see Art Jackson, Bill Jones. That's Frank Smith with the bongos for some reason. And Gerald Scott, who's also in the exhibit. Whenever you see those stars behind the bandstand, you know you're at the Orchid Club, which was behind the Vine Street Tavern at 12th and Paseo. Very popular venue. Anybody who came through always played at the Orchid Room. And it was quite a place. I'm learning a lot more about that these days. Originally from Birmingham, Alabama, Rusty Tucker initially played the trumpet and drums. And in 1948, he moved to Kansas City, where he led the house band at the Orchid Room. And while doing that, he backed up Little Richard, Della Reese, and he tells a very randy story about Della Reese at Swope Park, Ray Charles, and scores of other musicians visiting towns. And one night while he was on the stage at the Fandango Club, a dancer who was drunk bumped into his trumpet and knocked out his front teeth. He was unable to play the trumpet for a while, so he switched to drums and started singing in the classic Kansas City style. And for the next 34 years, Tucker worked a day job while performing in the clubs at night with Claude Williams, Jay McShann, and of course with the Scamps. Now, Dan captured Rusty with his trumpet and handkerchief. He's kind of channeling Louis Armstrong. That's one of his big influences. And Dan used a technique similar to what he used in his portrait of Myra Taylor. He lit Rusty with a flash unit and then shook the camera during a long exposure to blur the background. Like Jay McShann, Rusty had a wonderful smile that the camera loved. And he adopted Armstrong's What a Wonderful World and made it his own, really. One day, Elaine Lally showed up at the Sound Archive, and she worked in for UMKC, and she said, you know, I think Rusty should sing What a Wonderful World. Did you have a copy of that? And I said, yeah, I think we've got a copy around here somewhere. And he picked it up, and he really made it his own signature song. Wait a minute, here we go. Let me go back here. Let's hear a little taste of What a Wonderful World.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I watch them bloom for me and for you. And I say to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue, clouds of white, the bright, blessed day, the dark, sacred nights, and I'd say to colors of the rainbow, so pretty in the sky, are also on the faces of people passing by. I see friends shaking hands, saying, how do you do? They're really saying, watch them grow, they'll learn much more than I'll ever know. And I'd say to myself, what a wonderful world.
All right, Rusty Tucker. You know, one of the more moving moments I've ever experienced in my life was when he sang it at Pat Morrissey's funeral. And he sang it with tears in his eye. And he said it was the hardest thing he ever had to do. I hope you enjoyed this little appetizer of the banquet of images and the fine art of jazz at Waite in the Gallery. Now, keep in mind, after this is over, We're all going to filter downstairs, and there's going to be a jam session. We'll look at the exhibit and enjoy some more delicious Boulevard beer. But right now, here's Dan White. He's what I call, under Fish Fry, the chef of the exhibit. And he's going to talk a little bit about, he'll be available for questions up here for a little while. And then we'll, like I said, we'll all go downstairs and the tradition will jam on with these wonderful images and the music of a lot of the musicians that are in this exhibit. So, Dan.
Good evening. Nice to see all of these wonderful faces here. I really would just be happy to take a few questions, and I'll be downstairs too, so we can go listen to music, look at the photos, drink a little beer. So if you guys have any questions right now, I'm happy to entertain them.
What camera and film did you use for some shots, please?
Can you repeat the question too?
Sure. He wanted to know what kind of film I was using.
Camera.
Mostly a Hasselblad, which is a medium format, 2 1/4 square. Some of the images were shot with a 4x5, a view camera. And it was usually slow speed, fine grained film, because I wanted a certain quality to it. Later on, there was some of the photos are digital, and I used a Hasselblad digital back for that. Yes, ma'am. I don't really remember how I discovered it offhand, although as a photographer for years, we're always trying to hold the camera very, very steady. And as I discovered this technique, which is not new to me, other people had done it. So you're literally shaking the camera like that. I figured as I was getting older, that might be a good thing to try to do anyway. So, but it creates a certain effect that's kind of really pleasant on the background. And so what you do is the light that's on the subject's really in the dark until the flash goes off, which then freezes it and makes it very sharp and nice quality to it. The rest you don't really care about because it's kind of the background. So that's how you do it. Yes, sir.
Yeah, what was the time period that you discovered?
The time period that this was from 1987 to 2006. And I just sort of did it on my, you know, on my own when I had time, and I'd go meet these guys and women at various clubs, and I'd call them up and I'd say, hey, could I do a portrait of you? And first they didn't know who I was, so I'd show them some of my work. They'd say, okay. And then it got a little bit easier as I had more of a body of work, but yeah.
And I see you interviewed a lot of these artists. Was that process before you set the photo shoots, or was that all a work in progress?
Sure. He wanted to know about some of the, I did some anecdotal interviews with a lot of the musicians. Sometimes it was before, sometimes it was after. I didn't really have any rhyme or reason for that necessarily. But I wanted their recollections, their experiences. I didn't so much want the actual where they were or what they had played, but really their recollections, the funny stories. Some of them, they're on banners down there, and they're actually quite a bit of fun. But sometimes it was before, sometimes it was after art. So. Yes, sir.
Of all the artists that you photographed, what was the most memorable?
Oh, there are a lot of favorites. Some are personal friends that became personal friends. Others were photographs that worked really well. You know, I love the photo of Al Barty, one of my favorite photos, just because he was such a great guy. The first one I photographed, which was Piggy Miner in 1987. He just had such amazing stories. He would tell the story about riding in the back of a train car with Ella Fitzgerald. And they'd sit in the back, and they were just trying to kill time, and he'd take his trumpet and put a mute in it, and he'd play a lick, she'd sing it, she'd sing something, she'd scat something, he'd play it, and this is how they pass the time. And I thought, wow, it's so great to, what a wonderful life some of these people led. You know, so, anybody else? Yes, ma'am.
So, did you begin originally to
Well, I moved to Kansas City. I sort of fell in love with jazz in New Orleans, and I took a job with the Kansas City Star, and I began to learn of Kansas City's heritage in jazz, and I would go to the Foundation Hall and some of the clubs, and great faces and great stories, and I just figured someone needs to capture this for posterity, so that's kind of how it started. Yeah. Yes, ma'am. I haven't done that much traveling with it. It's been very well received. The Mid-America Arts Alliance, the show is the one, they're the ones that presenting it here, and it is on the road. It's been four or five places, and it's on the road for about another 4 years. And I think people really enjoy it. I mean, if you enjoy photography and the stories, and there's music that accompanies it, so we hope it keeps going for a while. There is, I think some of the places do have some music to go with it. We have a live soundtrack tonight, though, so even better, with my good friend Jim Lehrer and Mike Ming and Mike Warren. So I recommend we head down, listen to some music, drink some beer, look at some photos. Feel free to come up and ask me questions. Happy to do it.